Alaska now swims freer of federal entanglement than these other states.
Governor Parnell refuses to implement any aspect of the federal health care law. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 17th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a jury finds Rochelle Waterman guilty on one of seven counts.
She should have known that these guys were going to do it. That's the theory. I disagree with that theory because she was 16 at the time.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Governor Sean Parnell won't implement any aspect of the federal health care overhaul in Alaska, citing a Florida judge's decision calling the law unconstitutional. Two other federal judges have upheld the law, and one in Virginia upheld all of it except the controversial provision requiring citizens to buy health insurance or face penalties. The issue will almost certainly be resolved by the United States Supreme Court. But Parnell told the Juneau Chamber of Commerce today that the Florida ruling is the law of the land for now, and Alaska is not going to participate in the overhaul.
Alaska is a party to the Florida case with 26 other states. The judge gave us what we sought, that is a declaration that the individual mandate is unconstitutional, and the court barred implementation of the federal health care law. It's pretty much that simple, and Alaska is bound by the decision.
That means he'll skip a Friday deadline to apply for $1 million federal grant to set up a state-run health insurance exchange, giving individuals and small businesses access to information on insurance plans in Alaska. Parnell is the only governor in the country not to seek the grant, and the federal government is not likely to set up an exchange for the state. But the governor says accepting the money would have come with federal strings attached.
Alaska now swims freer of federal entanglement than these other states. These other states are now trying to figure out what to do with the oppressive constraints of money taken under an unconstitutional regime.
State Senator Hollis French of Anchorage was one of seven lawmakers who wrote the governor this week urging him to accept the insurance exchange grant. French says the governor is wrong about the Florida ruling being the law of the land and is harming Alaskans with his refusal to implement any part of the federal health care reform.
It's harmful to the 115,000 Alaskans who don't have health insurance, and it's harmful to those who do, who are going to benefit from the many beneficial reforms that were in the Affordable Care Act.
Parnell says the state is pursuing other opportunities to improve health care for Alaskans, including an evaluation of health insurance exchanges by the State Division of Insurance. He's also directed Commissioner of Health and Social Services Bill Struer to streamline enrollment in public assistance programs and work with health care providers to better serve senior citizens and children. French says the governor should propose legislation implementing his alternatives to the Affordable Care Act rather than just talking about them. Rochelle Waterman's long wait for a verdict on murder and conspiracy charges is over. Today, an Anchorage jury found the Craig woman not guilty on six of the seven counts against her. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
It's been more than a week, but the jury in the Rochelle Waterman case was in no hurry. After starting deliberations on February 9th, they emerged just after 12:30 Thursday afternoon with verdicts on the seven felony counts against Waterman. Guilty of negligent homicide, not guilty on all other counts of first-degree murder, second-degree murder, conspiracy, kidnapping, attempted murder, and burglary. Rochelle Waterman was not speaking to the press, but her defense attorney, Stephen Wells, says that the now 22-year-old Waterman was held to a reasonable adult standard by the jury in the one guilty charge.
What that means is that essentially she should have known that these guys were going to do it. That's the theory. I disagree with that theory because she was 16 at the time. We argued about this with the judge, and the judge said as he reads the law that she had to be held to a reasonable adult standard.
Rochelle Waterman was 16 in 2004 when her mother was murdered by two of her boyfriends.
While I understand the court's ruling, I think that's incorrect. I think there's been a lot of research about juvenile brain development, and I think there's a number of good reasons as to why she should have been held to a reasonable juvenile standard.
State prosecutors had tried to prove that Waterman wanted her mother dead and was aware of and participated in plans to kill Lori Waterman. But the defense brought to the stand expert psychologists, one of whom had evaluated Waterman twice, psychologists who testified that Rochelle Waterman was emotionally needy, suffered from extremely low self-esteem, and was emotionally behind her peers.
And I think that if she had been held to a reasonable juvenile standard, the verdict would have been not guilty, because I think there's a bunch of 16-year-olds that might have said, you know, hey, I didn't see this coming, and we now know why. But that wasn't the way that they were instructed.
Juror Judy McConnell says it was not easy to come to agreement on so many charges.
It's a very difficult decision.
McConnell would not comment on whether or not jurors had reached an impasse at points on some of the charges. At least twice this week, the jury had asked the court for guidance on how to proceed after becoming stalled on at least one felony count.
I don't think that there was anything that swayed anybody. It was just thoughtful consideration, very, very difficult, very many counts, and some people who really wanted to do what they considered the correct thing.
Jury selection began in late January, and jurors have been in court the better part of a month. The trial is the second for Rochelle Waterman. An earlier trial in 2006 was declared a mistrial. Defense Attorney Wells says an appeal on the one guilty charge against Waterman is probable. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Essential Air Service program that subsidizes flights to rural Alaska is safe for now. Arizona Senator John McCain's attempt to kill the program's funding died in the Senate today. McCain's amendment was tabled on a vote of 61 to 38. He targeted the program as a way to save money, even though it would have meant losing funds for airports in his home state. The Essential Air Service Program, or EAS, cost $200 million last year and helped pay for airport service in about 150 communities throughout the country. Alaska's congressional delegation has been fighting McCain because $12.5 million of that went to 44 Alaskan communities. On the Senate floor this week, Senator Lisa Murkowski said losing the EAS could destabilize Alaskan communities.
But I can say, without any reservation, that this amendment would create an economic and a transportation disaster for Alaska, including the loss of jobs, livelihoods, and would potentially impact health and medical situations.
Both Senator Murkowski and Democrat Senator Mark Begich showed their colleagues posters of Alaska and its vast size and limited road system. Begich, in his floor speech, warned losing EAS would put Alaskans out of work and isolate already distant villages.
The program has been a vital link for rural America. There are very real consequences to eliminating this program for my constituents, especially in the 44 communities served by the EAS program. 82% of Alaska communities are not on the road system and rely on aviation as a primary means of transportation. For goods, people, mail, it all has to come by aircraft.
McCain, however, says if Alaska feels that strongly, it should pay for the program itself, noting that the state has $12 billion in reserve and another $40 billion in the permanent fund. McCain criticized members of Congress who would vote down his amendment, saying it's time to tackle the ballooning federal debt.
And if we vote against my amendment, the majority votes against my amendment to eliminate Essential Air Service, the message to the American people as of November 2nd is we aren't serious. We aren't serious, because if we can't eliminate a program like this, how can we make the really tough decisions that are coming?
Even though McCain's attempt to kill the program stalled out, EAS isn't necessarily safe. It will still be scrutinized as members of Congress look for ways to shave spending. The president's new proposed budget funds it at only slightly lower levels than last year. Over in the House, Congressman Don Young successfully got a provision through committee Wednesday, continuing EAS only in Alaska and Hawaii and eliminating it in other states. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering a Tlingit war hero who waited too long for recognition of his service.
I would never say he was bitter, because he was not that kind of person, but he was hurt.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company's new president, Tom Barrett, today told legislators that the biggest problem facing the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is the low volume of oil being shipped from the North Slope. Designed to deliver up to 2 million barrels of oil per day, it is now carrying a little more than 600,000 barrels. Barrett and members of his staff specifically addressed the most recent oil spill on the line that began January 8th. Barrett says low oil flow is an emergency.
I'm looking at my flow model, and I'm thinking how long it takes to bring oil online, a couple of years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years for maybe interior fields, 10 years if your regulators will let you offshore, and I'm not liking it. And I'm not seeing that kind of urgency, the do whatever it takes. And by the way, if it turns out that the oil rigs are getting in each other's way up there, well, back down and say we did too much. I don't sense that.
Betsy Haynes, the oil movement's director for Alyeska, explained the effects of low volume in the line. She says TAPS was designed to handle warm oil and to carry that oil for shipment relatively quickly. But at current low flow rates, it is taking 15 days for oil to get from pump station 1 to the terminal at Valdez, and that leads to the problem.
It's very clear. Lower flow, longer transit time, that barrel of oil is in the system for many more days, and when it starts out at pump station 1 at a lower temperature, which it has done over the years, it is going to cool down over the 800 miles. It's a fact. It's physics. We are not going to change that. And with the cooling oil, lower turbulence, water can drop out of that line. Water has become our number one enemy with the lower temperatures that it's seeing in the winter and the wax.
Barrett had been president of Alyeska 1 week when the January 8th oil spill occurred. He says the dedication of the company's staff, their grit, he called it, got the line back in operation much quicker than originally anticipated. The Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission is calling on Alaska's U.S. congressional delegation to introduce subsistence whaling legislation before 2012. Officials say legislation is needed in case an international regulatory body fails to pass a harvest quota renewal. The AEWC passed this and four other resolutions Wednesday during the commission's two-day mini-convention in Barrow. KBRW's Jake Neer has the story.
The current five-year block quota for native subsistence whaling is ending in 2012. At that time, the International Whaling Commission will decide whether or not to renew or adjust the quota for another 5 years. But AEWC officials say the international body is dysfunctional and has used the quota as a bargaining chip in negotiations on other issues unrelated to native subsistence whaling. They fear a political gridlock in 2012, which could leave the 11 communities in the AEWC without a set quota. A subsistence renewal needs the approval of three-quarters of IWC member nations to pass. AEWC Commissioner Harry Brower says he'll be watching carefully to this year's IWC meeting in Jersey, England.
The outcome in what's happening in the IWC at this year's meeting will help us get an indication of what to expect. And we've had some communications indicating that we won't be so taken lightly. There's going to be a little bit of hesitant for the quota to be renewed.
According to the AEWC resolution, the International Whaling Commission does allow for subsistence whaling without a set quota to meet cultural and nutritional needs under domestic national legislation. It says such legislation needs to correspond with IWC requirements. The resolution, which passed unanimously during the mini-convention Wednesday, calls on Senator Begich, Senator Murkowski, and Congressman Young to introduce legislation along those lines and seek to pass it before the 2012 IWC meeting. AEWC Vice President George Amawok says similar legislation has been proposed in the past with the support of late Senator Stevens. That bill fell short, and Amawok says he acknowledges the challenge up ahead.
It's going to be a challenge all by itself in Congress as well to see if we have the necessary votes on both houses to pass this legislation. And I think we need to really work hard jointly as an organization to try to strive to get that. It's going to be a major effort, and time will tell, I guess.
He says it will be well worth the effort if protections can be put in place before 2012.
It's getting harder and harder to work with International Whaling Commission. Even though we abide by all their rules, do the census work, a lot of the requirements and mandates by the IWC, unfunded mandates, if you will, and it's getting harder and harder. In 2012, it's going to be a challenge, so I think we're better off going for domestic legislation. That's why we pushed this resolution on the floor.
With the conclusion of the AEWC mini-convention in Barrow, officials are holding their first quarter commissioners meeting Thursday and a conflict avoidance agreement meeting with the oil and gas industry Friday. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
The ornamental tree European bird cherry, or chokecherry, is being blamed for the deaths of three moose in Anchorage this winter. The plant is not toxic to humans or most other animals, but for ruminants, such as cattle, deer, and moose, the popular landscaping tree can be deadly. Dr. Kimberly Beckman is a wildlife veterinarian for the State Department of Fish and Game's Division of Wildlife Conservation. Beckman says chokecherry trees are not toxic all the time. Certain conditions in the fall create deadly compounds that turn into cyanide gas in the rumen, the largest chamber in a moose's stomach.
The soil pH, the amount of fertilizer it's had, whether it's been pruned at a certain time in its growth period, how many buds are on the branches, all these things contribute or affect how much toxin is built up. So in the same yard, one chokecherry of one species could be on the other side of the yard from another species, and only one of them at a given time would be toxic.
Beckman says the problem is not well studied and cases are rare. The three moose deaths this winter and one in 2006 are the only documented cases in moose.
What's really unusual about this situation is that chokecherries don't normally poison animals in the middle of winter. However, I think that it's possible that the warming trends, like a week before one of the poisonings, the temperature got up to 40 degrees in Anchorage, that perhaps the plant is essentially woken up and starts producing toxin again and then gets frozen like it was in the fall.
She says it doesn't take very long for the animal to die. Chewing the buds and tips of the branches breaks up the toxins, and even small amounts can create cyanide that will kill within 20 minutes. Beckman says in cases where cattle and deer have eaten toxic buds, they don't make it more than 100 feet from the tree before dying. She says one of the moose deaths in Anchorage was from eating branches a homeowner had pruned in the fall and then stashed under a deck. The branches were tested and contained lethal amounts of cyanide compounds, even though they had been trimmed months earlier. Beckman recommends mulching or disposing of such trimmings so moose scrounging for browse in late winter won't be poisoned. She says the third moose poisoned in Anchorage also had toxic levels of Japanese yew, which is toxic all the time to all animals and people.
Yew is a plant that is really pretty dangerous to have around as an ornamental, and I wouldn't recommend planting yew for your own children's safety also, because if they chew on it, it can be toxic to children.
The yew plant, spelled Y-E-W, is an evergreen with short needles. Beckman says chokecherry trees are an invasive that have quickly left backyards and are spreading at an alarming rate in Anchorage and displacing willow.
So by planting these ornamental plants and then having those seeds disperse and grow wild, we're actually taking away the food that the moose would normally browse on. So we've created this problem.
Beckman says another popular landscape plant that is very toxic is lilies. She says cats chewing the leaves, or especially the bulb, would die quickly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
A solar flare event. A solar flare event could result in a good aurora show tonight and Friday across the north, although cloud cover may keep us from seeing it. Chuck Deere, an emeritus professor of physics at the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute, says the intense solar flare activity earlier this week was the largest in 4 years, a period during which the sun has been unusually quiet. Deere says the energy from the event takes a couple days to reach Earth, but should fire up the aurora.
Material on the sun is given off. It consists of electrons and protons and some small amount of atoms and so forth that are blown outwards from the sun, and they carry with it the solar magnetic field. And that magnetic field hooks up with our magnetic field and generates currents. And these currents in our magnetic field are what really drive the aurora.
Deere says the northern lights will likely be brighter and visible from Earth locations much farther south than normal. Deere produces an online Alaska Aurora forecast for the Geophysical Institute. It currently calls for active aurora. The spike in solar flare activity can also affect high-frequency radio signals. Some commercial airliners have reported radio disruptions. Longtime Sitkin Roy Bailey died Saturday at the age of 84. Bailey served on the Sitka School Board, the Sitka Tribe of Alaska Tribal Council, the Historic Preservation Commission, and the board of the Sitka Historical Society. He also fought in World War II, a part of his life he didn't publicly acknowledge because for so long the federal government didn't acknowledge it either. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
Roy Bailey was drafted into the U.S. Army in 1944 and sent to Europe in 1945, where he was part of a machine gun team. He was wounded in an attack near the French-German border and evacuated to Paris for medical treatment. This is a recording of Bailey in 2007, talking to the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress about his time in medical care during World War II.
Somehow or other, the word got out that there was an Eskimo in the bunch. And everyone was stopping to see who the Eskimo was or where he was. So I got up on my elbow to see where this Eskimo was. I asked him where the Eskimo was, and the orderly said, "That's you, you dummy."
Bailey was not Eskimo. He was Tlingit from the Deshitan clan's end of the trail house, which is called Deshuhit. In the Army, as in much of American society at the time, discrimination was prevalent, and the psychiatrist who interviewed Bailey during his wartime hospital stay didn't believe that a quote-unquote Eskimo could have survived an attack in which all the white members of the squad were killed. The Army concluded his injuries were either accidental or self-inflicted, and when he was discharged, there was no acknowledgement that he had ever seen combat. He was denied the Purple Heart that he had earned.
I would never say he was bitter, because he was not that kind of person, but he was hurt.
Doris Bailey is his widow.
Deeply hurt and offended at not being believed. And so many years had passed that he had become resigned to the whole thing, and he just simply didn't talk about it, ever.
That changed in 1999, when people within the Sitka Tribe of Alaska petitioned the Defense Department to right its wrong. At a ceremony at Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage, Bailey was presented with 5 awards from then-Secretary of Defense William Cohen, including the Purple Heart and the Bronze Star.
And the healing just was amazing. And he got active in the American Legion, and he went to Veterans Day activities and Flag Day activities. And
those activities added to an already full life in Sitka. Twice elected to the school board, a delegate to the Tlingit and Haida Central Council, president of A&B Camp No. 1, and a member of the board of the Southeast Alaska Indian Cultural Center, the Sitka Community Association, and the Tribal Council of the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. He also served on the board of the Sitka Historical Society. Again, Doris Bailey, who is still on that board.
Well, I think both of us were kind of history buffs. And the fact that we knew so little about Roy's background, we know a huge amount more now than we did in the 1970s when we started on this quest. And it was important to us because we realized how much he had lost by not knowing his heritage.
Roy Bailey became an advocate for greater inclusion of Native history in the Sitka story.
He wanted the Tlingit part of the heritage of Sitka to be included in the Western world's museums and so forth. And he felt like it was such an integral part of the history of Sitka that how in the world could that be skipped?
And throughout his life, Doris Bailey says her husband acted as a bridge between the two cultures.
He would try to keep people from having very common misunderstandings that happen between the cultures and keep everybody on the right path so they don't misunderstand what's being said or done.
In addition to Doris Bailey, Roy Bailey is survived by 4 children, Gaylene, Anita, Janice, and John, 15 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, 2 sisters-in-law, a brother-in-law, and many nieces and nephews. This is Ed Ronco reporting in Sitka.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Jake Neer in Barrow, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD and consider sharing a portion with your favorite charity through Pick, Click, Give. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Indian Trust Land Amak IIM account Amak Bink Hluten, Hwallu Gingu Vakluten Indian Trust Agun, Nunnautan Klam Hwalla account Amak Bink Klam. Biugovit Aging Umoutan Illinik $3.4 billion settlement dam. Agochtor Ugovit Alangamak settlement dam Kanging Narotinik, Biunakotivnik Kanacht Darvikun. Website Amun IndianTrust.com Amun Biumoutan Hwaltoklorlugu 1-800-961-6109.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.